From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Zen-like Argo Studios in New York City. On our interfaith calendar, Monday marks the Christian feast of St. Michael and All Angels. The same day, the Hindu observance of Navaratri begins. Followers of Judaism are observing the 10 days of repentance, the high holy days, spanning the period from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur on October 4th. And by the way, I want to tell you that today is the fourth anniversary of Ray Kirstein, who is our producer and has been an absolutely superior source of excellence in producing this radio show. Ray brings a commitment to this show and the message of this show that is hard to imagine anywhere else, and it shows up in the excellence with which he produces the show. I want to say to Ray Kirstein, thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
More religion in politics. According to a new Pew poll, that's what people want.
While fewer and fewer Americans are taking traditional summer vacations these days, a lot of us do tend to tune out a bit during this season. Several significant surveys have come out suggesting some realignment in the relationship between religion and our culture. And there are likely to have been at least a few other news stories you've missed. So, this week, we'll look back at the summer's religion news with the Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, executive religion editor at the Huffington Post.
Are you a non-practicing bisexual?
I am married to my husband, and we are happily, monogamously married.
But you were bisexual.
Well, I don't think it's a past tense thing.
No?
No.
With all the progress lesbian and gay Americans have been making in the struggle for equal rights in this country, and growing focus on the challenges faced by transgender persons, there's a letter of the LGBT acronym that hasn't been getting much attention. The B, representing bisexual women and men. Advocacy groups have designated this past week as Bisexual Awareness Week, and the Religious Institute has just released a new guidebook titled Bisexuality: Making the Invisible Visible in Faith Communities. Later in the show, I'll be talking with lead author Marie Alford Harkey. But first,
from Manhattan to Melbourne, Copenhagen to Rio de Janeiro, waves of activists from around the world flooded city streets over the weekend to participate in the People's Climate March.
A defining issue of our time.
Alongside United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, celebrities and politicians also walked the talk.
Last Sunday, hundreds of thousands of activists marched in New York City, demanding more action on global climate change. Prominent among the many groups represented were a diverse range of faith-driven organizations. A clever representation of the threat of climate change was a giant wooden ark, the product of collaboration among Green Faith Sojourners and Auburn Theological Seminary. Why an ark? How successful was the march as world leaders prepared to gather at the UN to discuss climate change? And what's next for the interreligious and secular movement calling for responsible action on this crucial issue? Joining me in the studio is the Reverend Fletcher Harper, Executive Director of Green Faith. Fletcher, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be here.
Can you talk about the march itself? Does this mark a real turning point in public engagement, do you think?
The march was stunning. It's difficult to express how incredible and remarkable the experience was in this enormous crowd marching peacefully with such incredible diverse representation. And I think that it does mark a turning point. The diversity of groups that were engaged and that participated in the march, the passion with which they were engaged, and the sheer numbers. We were hoping that we'd top 100,000 for the march, and the most reliable figures I've seen say it was north of 400,000. That's a lot of people.
Tell me a story from Sunday.
You know, we had on 58th Street between 8th and 9th Avenue a gathering place for the faith community. And we knew it would be a while until we started to march. We had a pre-march prayer and invocation service. We had about six or seven different musicians, representatives of 15 or 20 different religious traditions. And we sang and prayed and celebrated for what ended up being 2.5 hours. And the energy just never dipped. It was the endurance, the excitement, the enthusiasm literally was contagious.
How prominent were faith-based organizations in planning the event?
We were right at the table along with other groups, along with labor unions, environmental groups, environmental justice groups, the scientific community. I mean, it was really an all-hands-on-deck event, and I felt wonderful in terms of the way that faith communities were welcomed and embraced. There's a recognition that, you know, we offer something that's really vital, which is that we can frame these issues as a moral issue, as humanitarian issues. We love people, we care about people, and we care about God's creation. And that's a unique role we can play, is framing it that way.
How diverse was the religious community?
Oh my gosh, it was wild. We had 39 different signs for different faith communities that were taking part. I'd say we had everything from Anglican to Zoroastrian, but we had all of the groups you'd expect: Jewish, Christian, Catholic, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist. But I think what was notable this time round was we also had a flag for agnostics. We had a flag for spiritual seekers. We had a flag for atheists. We had a flag for humanists. I mean, it was a genuinely big tent event for those communities of people who believe that there's some kind of meaning or purpose in life. And while they may describe it differently, they're united in that sense of purpose. And we came together in a big way.
Oh, that's terrific. What made this one click in a way that something else hasn't?
I think two things. I think the first thing is that, very sadly, there's been little to no meaningful progress at the governmental level, both domestically and internationally, on climate change. The U.S. continues not to offer the kind of leadership that we need to. There's no international binding treaty. The fossil fuel industry has tragically refused to become part of the solution. And because of that, frustration has built. And that frustration showed itself in a big way, peacefully and powerfully, last Sunday. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is that the religious environmental movement has started to come of age. We're not the new kids on the block anymore. We've been around for a while. We've established ourselves. We have programs that have reached thousands and thousands of faith communities, and that past organizing and network really showed up.
Yeah. Did it surprise you that national media seemed to be minimally involved in their coverage of this?
It was a disappointment. I can't say I'm tremendously surprised. We've heard over and over again from the mainstream media that when they talk a lot about climate change, their ratings go way down. And I think that that's what we saw on Sunday. Was here was a joyful march. I mean, this was a good story to cover because of the incredible creativity. Like you said, the arc. I mean, what a playful way to engage this issue. We had a huge inflated minaret and mosque there as well. So I think it's a reflection on the fact that our media have not really been up to the task in many ways, and that's why this has to be grassroots driven at a massive scale.
Fletcher, was there a story or stories about the increased speed of climate change that stuck with you on this?
I think that what has stuck with me over and over again has been the personal accounts of people impacted by climate change. So, for instance, Yeb Sano, the delegate to the UN from the Philippines, talking about the fact that a year after Typhoon Haiyan, there are 2 million people who are still homeless. I live here in the New York area, knowing how many people are still displaced or who've been impoverished by the impact of Superstorm Sandy. I think that people increasingly understand the brute force of the storms and the droughts that hit us. I think that what touches people is recognizing the human dimension to that, and the pain and the suffering that's part of it, and how we've got to do better.
I think that's one of the strengths that you bring to this, because there's so many people that think it's a debate about scientific ideology And it's really a conversation about the human condition and what may happen.
And I mean, I spoke last week to a mental health professional who had volunteered her services in the wake of Superstorm Sandy. And she talked about going into a shelter that was stuffed to the gills with people who'd been displaced. The level of anxiety was through the roof, police all over the place to help keep the peace. And she was directed to go offer some support to a young girl, sort of 9 or 10 years old. And she walked up to the little girl who'd been made homeless and said, "What can I do to help?" The little girl said, "Can you bring me a teddy bear?" I mean, this is the level on which, I mean, people have to realize this is not an ideological argument. This is about a decency towards our fellow human beings. And I'm confident we'll get there, but we need to get there faster.
Yeah. What was the role of Green Faith in helping organize this event?
We helped facilitate the planning conversations among the diverse faith communities. It helps that we're an interfaith organization because that way we have a role to bring people together. And I'm really proud of what we were able to do with that. It was a lot of fun. There's always some friction when you do that, but I thought it was pretty minimal in this regard. We had 6 or 7 different faith mobilization meetings around the city and around the greater New York area, a number of them with help from our friends at Avaaz, who did a super job. We had 150 clergy in the middle of July. I mean, someone joked that we'd had every clergy person that wasn't on vacation at that point. We had over 100 African-American and Latino clergy at an event with Al Gore. There were meetings in Westchester and Fairfield County on Long Island, everywhere. So we played a role in terms of gathering people, mobilizing them, and then we organized the pre-march prayer service, which was just, it rocked, if that's something you can say about a prayer service.
Well, okay, so we got to talk about the ARC. Where did that idea come from, and how did it get brought into being?
It really initially, to my understanding, was the brainchild of the World Council of Churches and some colleagues there. The idea was bounced around, and credit to Auburn Seminary for taking the ball and running with it. They found the person who built the ARC.
Do you think the presence of the ARC at the march might have confused some members of the creationist community?
You know, I'm honestly not sure. It's a good question. I know along the side of the ark, we had a sign that said, "We are all Noah's now." And I think a lot of people got that. It's such a familiar story. It's a story that people have such good feelings towards that I think it sent the message that we need to be about saving and protecting this incredible gift that we've received.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Green Faith itself. Talk about the next steps now for climate change activism with you and your partners.
We are putting a lot of effort now into a new campaign that we've launched called Our Voices, which is an international multi-faith campaign for a strong climate treaty. And we're going at that in 3 different ways. First, we're going to be lifting up for the media and for the public through social media, story after story of how faith communities are taking strong action on climate change. The second thing we're going to be doing is seeking to build the largest ever online faith community in support of any public issue and to do it in support of action on climate change. Politicians listen to numbers, and we want them to see that there are literally tens of millions of people of faith around the world who care about this and who want action. And the third thing we're doing is we're going to be doing some iconic public spiritual action. So, for instance, this past weekend on Sunday at 1 p.m. in different time zones around the world, churches and synagogues and mosques and temples rang their bells, sounded their shofars, sounded their chimes or their prayer gongs, chanted mantras outdoors, prayed outdoors, all with the idea of saying, we're concerned about caring for creation and climate change. We want action now. And we're looking to do more of that in the future.
I do wish, though, you would just again describe what Green Faith is and how people can get involved in it in case someone doesn't know.
Sure. We are an interfaith environmental organization. We work with faith communities from a diverse range of communities around the country and increasingly around the world to help them put their beliefs into action for the earth.
Why should a person join Green Faith and keep up with what's going on?
Because it's the best and most meaningful and most enjoyable way to engage your faith in a new day. environmental issues are the moral issue of our time. The natural world reveals God to us in a way that's more compelling and more beautiful than just about anything else. Why wouldn't you want to be part of that? You can find us at greenfaith.org. We're on Facebook at Green Faith. We're on Twitter at Green Faith World. And our new Our Voices campaign is www.ourvoices.net.
The Reverend Fletcher Harper is the Executive Director of Green Faith, inspiring, educating, and mobilizing people of diverse religious backgrounds for environmental leadership. Fletcher, I'm glad that you're with us again. You're always welcome here on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for your work and thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
A couple of recent national surveys made headlines with findings suggesting some change in the relationship between religion and culture in this country. There's also been some other religion-oriented news that you might have missed over the summer months. So to look at both the surveys and the headlines, I'm delighted to be joined again by the Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, Executive Religion Editor for the Huffington Post, good friend. Paul, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
What are some of the religion stories from recent months that just come to the front of your brain right off?
When I think about the last few months, one of the biggest stories, of course, was Ferguson. And one of the, I would say, underreported stories was the role that clergy and religious people played from the very beginning. I talked to some people who were there the first night that protests started. Clergy were there. They were praying at a prayer, interfaith prayer service that happened the day after the event, and they were in the front lines and sometimes actually were experiencing the violence of the police themselves. And they were also a real liaison sometimes because they also, some of them knew the police. And so they were able to foster conversations. We think of these interfaith groups or these, you know, clergy, and you kind of think, oh, yeah, well, they're doing their thing. When a crisis happens, and the other example I think of is Newtown, the shooting there, all of a sudden, people turn to the clergy. And especially in this case, the clergy put themselves on the line with the people. And it was a beautiful thing and very powerful witness to the courage of clergy and also hopefully the healing power of clergy. And it wasn't just clergy, I should say. It was really religious leaders. And I would say the mainstream media, or many of us might not immediately think of, such as the Nation of Islam, as well as Jewish. I talked to one rabbi who said they had, it's from an interracial congregation. So it wasn't just that they were coming in out of solidarity. It was their own community members who lived there who, you know, said, we need to be there. So there was all sorts of good things that happened. It also reminds me of a program that has just started in Rochester called the Clergy Patrol, where they also have a somewhat fraught relationship between the community and the police. The Clergy Patrol are 100 members of the clergy who go out on patrol with the police in order to foster positive relations. And I think that if we can see more kind of pragmatic ways that religious people, people of faith of all kinds, can get out there and be a resource to the community of healing and hope and reconciliation, that's what we should all be about.
I can't help but ask you, do you think we're making progress with interreligious relations?
Well, it makes me think of the other story that was so big this summer, which is the Gaza war. Israel and Gaza went to war, and it represented to me a certain fragility of our interfaith conversations because there was no conversation. People really could not talk about it. Jewish and Christians, Jews and Muslims who knew each other well could not find even the language to talk about it. And it made me think, well, maybe we really need to be a little harder in our discipline with one another. How do we really have the conversations? By the way, Jews have a hard time talking with other Jews about this issue. So this is not just an interreligious question. This is an intra-religious question as well. That said, it made me wonder, like, where are some of the major interfaith groups that we turn to? They were very, very silent about it. They just could not find a way even to have a productive conversation. So I think in many ways, our interfaith groups are very strong. I mean, there's the kind of a new moment in the climate change march. For instance, there were clergy all over the place, and it was really a fun, positive environment. It showed you. But it's the hard stuff. And I hope that somehow we can learn from that and figure out ways to be in community and dialogue with one another in hard moments like that.
You know, Paul, when I came to this job at the Interfaith Alliance, one of my first major disappointments was seeing a situation in which people who were totally in sync in interfaith dialogue about domestic issues could not handle international issues. And I've even had people try to make the case to me that they are involved in interreligious dialogue on domestic issues because they can't be involved in interreligious dialogue on international issues.
I don't really buy that, I have to say. I think it's something that either you have a heart for conversation with people with whom you don't agree on some fundamental questions of theology, you have to be able to talk about everywhere. And the reason it's so hard is that it's so close to people's hearts. Everybody was feeling defensive. Everybody was feeling vulnerable. Everybody was feeling under attack. And those are the moments that we have to be able to rise to respect one another, to feel one another's pain. One thing that happened at the beginning of New York University's school year, they held an event, the rabbi, the imam, and other religious leaders held an event where students were able to talk uninterrupted and everyone would be silent, just listening to them. It went on for about an hour and a half, and it was just people talking about the summer and how hard it had been. Ferguson, Israelis, Gazans, you know, people from all over the world were able just to say, this is why this hurt, and other people just listened. And for me, that was a start. That was actually a very powerful start. And from there, we can take it to maybe having a constructive conversation about how we can come together to heal.
You are in a very interactive situation with the Huffington Post. What religion subjects have generated the most reader response for you?
It really depends. Sometimes it's breaking news that is very, very good, very exciting, and people want to know about it. For instance, today, Jimmy Carter said something very favorable, you know, in a question and answer. He said, Jesus never discriminated against anyone, and we shouldn't discriminate against LGBT people. That has done very well for us. On the other hand, ISIS is very interesting to people. Muslims especially really want to talk about ISIS. So we have had a couple different stories, very different in their tenor. One of them was about the 100 Muslim scholars who came together and wrote a very, very strong Quranically based theological response to Islamic State and basically blasting them for not understanding theology, not understanding Islam. This was not a liberal group, by the way. It's not the kind of theology that more liberal Muslims would appreciate, but it is a fundamentally strong argument, a refutation completely. That has done extremely well. Likewise, something that was just happening on Twitter, which was a hashtag called Muslim Apologies, which was these Muslims who are like, okay, there's a few thousand people in Iraq and Syria who are really messing things up, and there are a billion of us who are expected to apologize for it. So these very, you know, Twitter savvy, funny people were like apologizing for, like, you know, the halal food was cold when it arrived on your plate, things like that. Very funny, you know, Muslim apologies. So we've been covering this from different angles, and all of those stories have been doing well because, of course, Muslims are very passionate about this issue.
Yeah. A recent Pew poll showed 72% of Americans saying religion is losing influence in public life, and most of them say it's a bad thing. The same survey discovered a growing number, nearly half of respondents, saying churches should play a bigger role in culture and politics. Does that surprise you?
It does surprise me. I think that the numbers are slightly skewed towards evangelical Christians who really strongly feel this lack of influence and would like to have more freedom in the pulpit to talk about political electoral ideas. I have to say that many in the liberal church would, you know, hear that and do that as well. So we shouldn't be hypocritical about it. We should recognize that this is happening. People are talking about politics. The question about whether or not more people want religion in public life, I'm not sure exactly how that was phrased, because it goes against a lot of the ideas of us becoming a more secular country, more nones, and an actual fatigue of people hearing about how God feels about our personal lives and things like that. What I think it does indicate on some level is an unease, an essential unease of the direction of the country, and a wish for something that can ground us in something real, maybe some sense of our more positive, greatest generation past. And so I think that that can be a nostalgia that makes sense to me. But as far as the real bigger trend, people being more interested in religion that is out there for the individual, but is not actually influencing the way we are together as a society, which could be actually a bad thing. I mean, if we didn't have the history of, say, the social gospel or the civil rights movement, those were strongly religiously influenced movements. And so we want to remember that this is a double-edged sword. Let's try to figure out where our morality will come from and tap into that, the best of it, from all different sources, secular and religious.
The Pew poll finds public support for marriage equality dipping 5% from earlier this year to 49%. The same change in the percentage of respondents who think homosexuality is a sin. That number is now at 50%. Have you seen anything that might confirm this admittedly small shift?
I have no idea, honestly. I was kind of shocked by that. Young people and more secular people are clearly, you know, embracing the full equality of LGBT people. And yet there is a segment of society that may become more entrenched against the idea of full equality before we actually move on to full equality. I think they feel it's part of this sense of being under attack. Our values are under attack. I think it's something that gay rights activists should be very aware of and figure out, well, how do we continue to talk to people about who we are, about why our lives matter, how we actually just want the same thing as everybody else? I think that that will continue to move the needle. And I think long term, we're going to see an overwhelming acceptance within the next 10 to 15 years.
Yet another survey, Duke University's National Congregation Study, shows a 10% jump in faith communities accepting lesbian and gay members, although the overall acceptance number is still only 48%. Of course, that's going to vary widely across denominations. I see, and I think I hear you seeing, a trend of acceptance.
Well, we've also seen not just a trend of acceptance, but we've seen denominations change their laws to allow for gay people to be ordained, gay ministers to be married, things like that. So it's not just around a broad sort of abstract acceptance. It's really written into the books, which is a powerful change and hard to do in denominations. You know, that's not nothing. And so I think that it is important to recognize the gains that continue to be made. One thing that struck me about that last survey was that Catholic support had actually gone down. We asked the author of that report at Duke, and he said, you know, it's become a very salient issue for the Catholic Church, for instance, especially with Catholic schools. Should they be allowed to fire gay people? This is happening a lot. People are being forced to take sides in concrete terms in a way that maybe they hadn't been 10 years ago. But what I think eventually, again, we're going to see this going forward, and it may never reach 100%. But I think as long as there's a tipping point, my hope is that very soon we will break 50% and get up to 60 and 70%, where we just really recognize that gay people are human people, and this is just going to be a part of our, hopefully, our families and our friends and the human community, and not kept on the outside of the circle any longer.
I think what you've just said certainly impacts the other one I was going to mention. It's also from Pew that dramatically more LGBT persons identify as non-religious, 48%, than the general population. I think I could understand that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think in that same poll, actually, there's a more of a sense of in the middle. The question they ask is, are you strongly religious or are you strongly atheist? For the strongly religious, they are much less. But if you're a moderate, you see almost identical numbers of LGBT and non-LGBT identifying as moderately religious. And this is a very blatant and open making a case for more moderate, more open-minded, more progressive religion. If you have your mind open to the changing way that religion and spirituality is practiced in day-to-day life and are not so dogmatic that you are looking towards the past for all the answers instead of recognizing this spirit could be moving right now, then you're more likely to be open to the idea that, oh, those are my neighbors who I never thought they could be my neighbors. And that's part of the interfaith movement as well. We are open to the other in a different way than we would have been 100 years ago. It's progress, and it's important, and it should be a fundamental, essential idea of what it means to be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim in the 21st century. And so we can't be bashful about that. We can't be bashful about the authentic nature of these kind of religious faith traditions, the more progressive, open, constantly evolving, and widening the circle at every opportunity.
I can't be in an election year and have you here in front of me and not ask you, how are we doing in this election year with the delicate balance between religion and politics?
I honestly think that there has been a lot less religion in this midterm, in part just because it's not really in the front of the news. I mean, maybe on very local races that is happening and people are identifying as one thing or not as another. But I don't think we've seen a kind of concerted rallying of, anyone. it doesn't seem like that's out there. I think that there are people who are voting on important issues. Maybe Latinos feel somewhat abandoned by the White House, although I'm not sure, but I think it's more issues, and I don't think anybody's rallying around the cross and the flag right now, anyway.
The Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch is executive religion editor at the Huffington Post. He's the former associate dean of religious life and the chapel at Princeton University, and he is a sought-after commentator and public speaker. You understand why. Paul, I always value your insights and enjoy the discussion, and I really appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It was so great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
With the advances that we've seen in the past couple of years for what are often shorthanded as LGBT rights, the situation for subgroups of this blanket label is not uniform. Certainly, the transgender community faces unique and daunting hurdles. But as we wrap up what leading advocacy groups have deemed Bisexual Awareness Week, where do things stand for this minority group, both in society and especially in faith communities? The Religious Institute, always at the forefront of important issues at the intersection of faith and sexuality, has just published a comprehensive new guidebook titled Bisexuality: Making the Invisible Visible in Faith Communities. And I'm very pleased to welcome the lead author, Marie Alford Harkey, to State of Belief Radio. Marie, welcome.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
What are some of the unique challenges faced by bisexual persons in a faith environment?
Well, invisibility is exactly the challenge that is faced by bisexual people, both in faith communities and in society. One of the most striking findings that we discovered in working on the book was that fully 40% of the LGBT community identifies as bisexual. So they make up the largest portion of the LGBT community, and yet they are the ones who are the most invisible. And, you can sort of see why. It's because we make assumptions. We assume what a person's orientation is by who they're partnered with. So when I, for example, show up in a new faith community with my wife, people assume I'm a lesbian, and as luck would have it, they're right. Mm-hmm. But when my friend John shows up in a new congregation with his wife, people also assume that he's straight, and that's not correct because mm-hmm. he identifies as bisexual. So it's definitely the invisibility that is the biggest harm for bisexual people. Mm-hmm. One of the other really interesting findings from the Pew survey was that 70% of lesbian and gay people say that most of the important people in their life know about their sexual orientation. But strikingly, for bisexual people, that number is 28%.
Is it safe to say that there is a reticence among bisexual persons to talk about their bisexuality?
Well, yeah. And part of the reticence comes from the societal stereotypes and myths that surround being bisexual and surround bisexual people. The myths about, for example, that bisexual people can't be monogamous or that bisexual people are taking advantage of straight privilege. And the sad thing is that what we find is that bisexuals are marginalized both in the LGBT community and in the wider community for some of those same reasons. And so it's really hard for bisexual folks, A, to come out, so mm-hmm. to speak, and to figure out how to keep coming out in different settings. But it's also about the assumptions and the harmful myths and stereotypes that are out there that make it difficult for bisexual people to feel comfortable coming out. And that's what the guidebook is all about, is creating an atmosphere, whether you know you have bisexual people in the congregation or not, mm-hmm. that feels safe for people of all sexual orientations so that their faith community feels like a safe place.
Marie, what made you think this was the right time for a guidebook on bisexuality?
Interestingly, you know, what we know is that there's lots of progressive congregations, denominations, and movements that have been working really hard to explicitly welcome and affirm lesbians and gay men. And that work has been going on for 50 years or more in many denominations. But what we're becoming aware of is that there have been some progressive congregations that have done a good job with paying attention to gender identity mm-hmm. and to the unique needs and concerns of transgender people, but there is almost nothing out there addressing the unique concerns and needs of bisexual people. Mm-hmm. When we originally talked about this project with the American Institute of Bisexuality, what we assumed is that we would be curating a lot of resources and gathering things that people of faith and faith leaders could use. And what we discovered was that there was just very little to curate. There were very few congregational resources. Almost all of them were more than 10 years old. And right before the book went to press, I got an email from one of the big LGBT faith organizations, and they have a huge clearinghouse of resources. And they asked if we knew of any resources on bisexuality for congregations. It was really fun to say, why, yes, actually, we're writing that book.
That's wonderful. Tell us, what are the key issues that you address in the book?
So the book is actually divided into three parts, and we start with sort of bisexuality basics. So we talk a little bit about what is sexual orientation, and we pull together some really good research about definitions and models of sexual orientation that go beyond sort of binary understandings. We talk about myths and facts, the prevalence of bisexuality, and about our obligation as faith communities and religious people to help heal the suffering that is actually worse for bisexual people than lesbians and gay people just because of the fact that they're so invisible and because of the stereotypes that are out there. And then in the second part of the book, we address sacred texts and religious traditions and do some really interesting theological reflection and talk about denominational statements. And then in part three, we get down to the sort of nitty-gritty of what can congregations do to be more welcoming and affirming, what do religious professionals need to do to be bisexually healthy. And we talk about worship, preaching, all of the different kinds of areas mm-hmm. that are part of a faith community's life.
So what kind of misinformation is out there that's getting in the way of progress?
Yeah, there's so much misinformation. Some of the myths that we address center around, for example, bisexuality is a phase. It's just something that people go through before they're ready to identify as gay or lesbian, or that bisexual people just don't exist. They're just afraid to come out as gay or lesbian. And so we actually go into the scientific research that says, actually, no. There have been studies that show that bisexuality is a distinct and enduring sexual orientation. There's also this one that came up in the Larry King interview with Anna Paquin, right, that if you get married, if you're a bisexual person and you get married, then you're not bisexual anymore, which is, you know, sort of an interesting argument, as if somehow, you know, if you're a heterosexual person and you're not married, you're not heterosexual anymore. And there's also some really pervasive, harmful myths about bisexual people in relationships with people of another sex or taking advantage of straight privilege. And that's one of those myths and stereotypes that really gets bandied about in the LG community. And it's really hard for bisexual people to feel safe in those communities, even though they claim to be LGBT communities.
Right.
I think probably the most prevalent one is that bisexual people are promiscuous. They can't possibly be monogamous. I would love to just read you a little blurb from the book from Reverend Janet Edwards, who's an out bi Presbyterian minister, where she talks about a pastor friend invited her to have coffee after he heard that she's bi, because she came out fairly publicly. She wrote about it from a faith perspective. And she said he wanted to warn her that adultery is prohibited by the Ten Commandments. And she said she was really confused by this until what she realized was he assumed that because she was bisexual, there was no way she could possibly be faithful in her marriage.
Yeah. We have heard people in the church say, well, it's all right that you're a homosexual, you just can't act on it. When it comes to bisexuality, are we asking that the bisexual person discipline herself or himself regarding one aspect of their sexuality?
If you say to someone who identifies as gay or lesbian, you're welcome to be gay or lesbian and be part of our faith community, but you can't act on that.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is true as if you say to a bisexual person, it's fine that you're bisexual, but if you're going to end up with a partner, you need to end up with a partner of the opposite sex. That's sort of saying the same thing, right? Which is that you don't get to live out who you are as a human being. We're going to circumscribe that as a particular faith community. And thankfully, there are an awful lot of faith communities where that is no longer the case for lesbians and gay men.
What actions by faith leaders and communities of faith would be most helpful? What are you saying in the guidebook about that?
So the number one thing is to not make assumptions about a person's sexual orientation. And that goes back to the anecdote I related about just because someone walks into your community with someone of the same or another sex doesn't mean you know what you need to know about their sexual orientation. And so the best thing to do is to not make an assumption until you know otherwise. And when you know, it's no longer an assumption.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think that is really true is that educating oneself about bisexuality and about sexual orientation and human sexuality in general allows us, and especially allows religious leaders, to have an awareness that just you can't go back from. When Reverend Hafner and I started working on this book, the more we got into the material, the more we realized we were becoming bisexual activists, because you can no longer not notice all the ways in which bisexual people are erased from the conversation, both in lesbian and gay spaces as well as in larger society. So just that awareness and paying attention to language, for example, it's not gay marriage, it's same-sex marriage, or it's marriage equality. It's not gay rights, it's human rights, or at the very least, LGBT rights. And having an awareness, we caution faith communities that if you're going to say you're welcoming of LGBT people, then you need to make sure that that's actually true. And you probably want to say the whole thing every once in a while. You want to actually say lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender so that people get the idea that you're understanding that all of those different identities interact in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Marie, what comes first? Increased bisexual visibility to demonstrate that a need for inclusivity exists, or self-education on the part of leaders and communities to create a more welcoming environment?
You know, what I really hope is that the self-education comes first. And one of the reasons for that is that no matter whether we know that there are bisexual people in our congregations or not, the ideal, right, is to create safe and healthy places for people of all sexual orientations and regardless of sexual identity or attraction. What is also really wonderful is that we don't have to focus on just welcoming those poor people who have been shunned, what we can also focus on is what are the gifts of reflecting on human sexuality in all of its complexity and diversity? What gifts does that bring us as a faith community in terms of our theological reflection, mm-hmm. in terms of how we understand justice issues and how we act on those? I really do hope it's the awareness that comes first rather than some sort of crisis of need, or, you know, it is my hope that every congregation out there would say, well, yes, we definitely need to do this. We need to see this book. Becoming a congregation that is more welcoming of bisexual persons actually affects a whole lot more people than just those who identify as bisexual, because there are any number of folks who have attractions or feelings or behaviors that we might label or that scientists might label bisexual, who themselves have never used that label, but who would be amazed and so gratified to hear themselves in a conversation, in a sermon, in a teaching. And so I think that that's a really important point for faith leaders to keep in mind, that you're not always going to know who the folks are out there.
Marie Alford Harkey is Deputy Director for the Religious Institute, an aspirant for Holy Orders in the Episcopal Diocese of Connecticut. Marie is a Provincial Coordinator for Integrity USA, the organization working for full inclusion of LGBT people in Episcopal faith communities. She's the lead author of the new guidebook from the Religious Institute titled Bisexuality, Making the Invisible Visible in Faith Communities. It's available online at religiousinstitute.org. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. The kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that we strive to present every week is virtually impossible to find anywhere else. So please consider helping us to keep this important work going. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us this week, all week long, on Facebook and Twitter. The listener line is 202-681-4246. As always, we encourage you to tell other people about this show and encourage them to listen, and after they listen, to get back in touch with you so that you can have a conversation of your own about what we've had conversations about on the air. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. What an intersection. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Was the son of a preacher man, you see what he was.